I'm honored to speak here in such an eminent setting, and my brief is to speak about the protection of populations under grave threat, and I shall focus particularly on mass atrocities. The death rate from mass atrocities has exceeded by far those from other emergencies. Over historic time and in broad aggregate terms, mass atrocities have killed many more people than the other traditional scourges of humanity. This slide shows the aggregate mortality since history began, since Adam and Eve got together. And all through history, humanity has feared hunger, war, disease, and you can see the numbers of people killed over the last thousands of years on that. This is very rough epidemiology, very rough data, obviously. But you can see that the number of people killed by mass atrocities is far in excess of wars, famines, and so on. This may surprise you. Some mass atrocities, when they happen as emergency catastrophic events, can completely distort the normal mortality patterns they generate. So, for example, the 1994 Rwanda genocide, you can see what it did to African mortality rates all through the 1990s. Far more people died per 100,000 per year because of Rwanda impacting the whole of Africa, as opposed to the normal diseases which you expect that, which is HIV and malaria. So this is extremely serious cause, an extremely serious public health problem. I use the term mass atrocity as applying to violent and other coercive acts that are intentionally perpetrated on a large number of people to kill or cause terror, pain, and suffering, or to do the same to a group of people of any size targeted specifically because of an aspect of identity. Over time, the term has come to encompass the following categories of crimes: genocide and ethnic cleansing, crimes against humanity, and war crimes as legally defined in the Rome Statutes of the International Criminal Court. As such, mass atrocities are not to be conflated or confused with general violence or conflict or war, though of course mass atrocities often occur during wars and conflicts. But throughout history, most mass atrocities occur outside wars. Over the ages, man has become ever more inventive in terms of inflicting cruelty. Thus, mass atrocities include, but are not limited to, murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, imprisonment under rigorous conditions, torture in varied physical and psychological forms, pillage, rape, sexual slavery, forced pregnancy, forced sterilization, forcible transfer of children from one group to another, and deliberately inflicting physical conditions such as starvation and destruction of livelihoods, calculated to bring about the destruction or removal of a group, and many, many other forms of degrading or inhumane treatment. Of course, with such an array of means and methods available to commit atrocities, its impact is seen not just in terms of death rates, but of even greater importance is the whole-scale destructive impact on the well-being, mental equilibrium, and way of life of people, communities, and society as a whole. And the sequel of mass atrocities include chronic, difficult-to-treat consequences. Apart from malnutrition, infectious diseases, numerous studies have shown cognitive impairment, neurological and psychological dysfunctions, depression, chronic pain, and post-traumatic stress disorder. The burden of disease can be increased for decades to come. For example, the attributable risk among the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic bomb survivors of 1945 has been 46% for leukemia and over 10% for solid cancers. And in the last genocide of the 20th century in 1994 in Rwanda, up to 500,000 women were raped in 100 days, two-thirds of whom got infected with HIV. And now in the case of Sudan, which spawned the first genocide of the 21st century starting in Darfur in 2003 and extending to the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile now, some 4 million people are directly affected as refugees and IDPs, suffering starvation, sexual and physical violence, social degradation, torture, imprisonment, and many other brutalities. And in Syria, the latest estimate is that some 7 million people, one-third of the population, are destitute and traumatized to varying but worsening extent. But beyond the obvious physical and health impacts lie the even more worrisome transgenerational effects on the minds and hearts of people that generate repeated cycles of hatred, violence, and atrocity as memories of insult and injury are passed on to inflame the passion and grievances of the survivors and the children of the victims. But finally, what are the broad global trends? We can see from this slide that by and large, as time has gone by, the struggle against hunger and disease has made progress. But you might want to reflect on this slide and ask the question, why are human beings becoming more quarrelsome and cruel? So if you look at this slide, and from all the data we can get together across history, in 7,000 years of human history, before the 20th century, there were roughly about 40 million people who died during what we may call wars. And you can see in 100 years alone, in the 20th century, that number has more than tripled. Of course, population has increased during that time. But if you allow for that by calculating rates, you can see there's a 15-fold increase in deaths from wars and conflicts. And if you compare that then with the number of people who have died from genocides, what we may call genocides, you can see that in 100 years alone of the last century, an 8-fold increase of number of people who have died. It seems that as we get more developed, more educated, we actually become more cruel, more quarrelsome, and less peaceful. My next remarks will focus on the ultimate malign or evil form of trauma, in other words, genocide. But a lot of what I have to say may also apply to other forms of mass atrocity. The term genocide was invented by Raphael Lemkin in 1944, born out of the Nazi experience and the Holocaust that went on to be enshrined in the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, adopted at the United Nations in 1946. So this is the well-known definition of genocide. I won't read that. You can see it for yourself. A public health model approach can help us to understand why genocides happen and to reduce their impact and prevent their recurrence. This calls for an analysis of the symptoms and signs of the condition from which we may deduce an understanding of risk factors and vulnerabilities that may then go on to provide insights on points for prevention and intervention. Genocide is the most heinous mass crime known to humanity. That is why it is labeled as an extraordinary or special evil, and the starting point is realizing that such evil has happened in every continent, in every culture, and in every epoch. Thus, to commit this special evil is an indelible part of our shared human condition. Evolutionary psychologists have theorized that natural selection has left deep traces of design in our minds, and at least some of those designs leave us evolutionarily primed with the capacity for evil. In other words, our human nature endows us with psychological mechanisms that leave us all capable of extraordinary evil when activated by proximate cultural, psychological, and social constructions. Incidentally, there is a crucial gender dimension in that the key perpetrators that conceptualize, design, plan, and direct genocide are usually men. There is, through history, not a single genocide that has been recorded as having been designed or led by a woman. This is done by men. Thus, the propensity to commit evil is part of the normal human condition. In other words, genocidal killing is done by ordinary people like you and I, who may be bad but cannot be considered mad. Reflecting, for example, on the experience of the Nazi machine or in Rwanda, it shows that massive killing on a systematic and efficient basis cannot rely on unreliable psychopaths, but on the organized efforts of a large number of ordinary people working from and within formal institutions. Because by and large, mad people, psychopaths, they are not efficient enough to organize yourself and to kill hundreds of thousands or millions of people. You have to be very sane. You have to be organized. This Hitler was not mad. Pol Pot was not mad. The Rwanda genocidaires were not mad. To call them mad would be to actually do psychologically affected people a disfavor. So it's very important to understand that that a lot of research done on these people, as leaders who actually commit and direct these things, they're perfectly sane people. The second key insight is that the product of genocide is a huge organized and bureaucratic activity because of the systematic sequence of actions needed for its success. A random mob cannot do this. Thus, genocide throughout history has been executed by state authorities, mostly governments, because only governments have the means and capacities to organize on the scale necessary to achieve the design in practice. Genocide is, by and large, a crime of governments. But why do governments turn to preying on their citizens, and why do ordinary citizens agree to be co-opted into becoming extraordinary killers? You're all nice people here. But what would happen if somebody came along and said, go and kill everyone in the neighborhood? You might turn bad. Why? And this is a question that has been taxing researchers for a long time. But back to our public health model. Political scientists have even calculated relative risk ratios for the key risk factors, as in this table. So political scientists have been looking at genocides over the last, since the Second World War in particular. And here's the relative risk factors on the public health model on what makes a society prone to commit mass atrocities such as genocide. And you can see that the greatest risk factor is, of course, a history of a previous genocide. And then the other factors, I think you can imagine what they are: autocratic regimes, a closed society, an elite which represents, which doesn't, elite government which doesn't represent all the people, and of course a high, and you can see that only at the very bottom is internal war and regime crisis there as a relatively low risk factor. This confirms empirical evidence that genocide does not happen out of the blue. It is preceded by the warning signs of pernicious supremacist ideologies that may be racist, ethnocentric, nationalist chauvinistic, or religiously intolerant. These create deep exclusions within society of insiders and outsiders, with the former being deliberately trained and supported to turn on the latter. Often this is promoted as a patriotic duty sanctioned by the legitimacy and the power of the state. And further, the final solution is often preceded by little practiced genocides. Everyone knows about the Rwanda genocide of 1994, but not many people know that in Rwanda there were many genocides in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. And the Darfur genocide of 2004 was preceded by the Nuban atrocities of the 1990s, and succeeded by the current Nuba and Blue Nile atrocities that started in 2011. These practices runs at committing mass murder allow both the testing and refinement of ideologies and tools, and pushing the boundaries of impunity, in other words, what you can get away with, both domestically and internationally. But even if evil-minded leaders or governments do this, why do public have to follow so easily? In short, on the public health model, what are the vulnerabilities on which the risk factors act to convert them into a full-blown crisis of genocide? Are there specific forces at play that build on the evolutionary weakness of all humans that I mentioned above? In other words, the inherent capacity in all of us to become evil. Genocide requires categorical murder, meaning murder according to the definitions of people being put into categories or identities. And to do that, the killers need to be presented with a cause to kill that is far more important than that of preserving life. Noting that humans are the only creatures that are self-aware that they are going to die, the fear of death is a source of terror that can only be managed by allegiance to a group's own worldview or culture, including their own set of values, and the self-esteem that comes from belonging to the group. This is what psychologists tell us. Terror management theory suggests that the power of a group over its members is the extent to which the group answers to the human problem of mortality. So membership of a golf club, for example, offers no promise of immortality, even if you are a world golf champion. But a race, an ethnic group, a nation, a religion, invite each of us to belong within that group that is then seen to have a long past and unlimited future. This is immortality. Thus, getting a share of that group immortality is a cause for which no one can easily, or at which one can easily justify killing other groups, especially if you have been indoctrinated to believe that your own group is more deserving, superior, but is under threat. Indeed, under these circumstances, it becomes a sacred duty of all good ordinary people to eliminate other groups because your loyal duty demands it. In this way, ordinary good people become really bad people through a shockingly easy transformation. To reiterate, genociders are bad, but they are not mad. Those who commit mass atrocities, not just genocide, but other mass atrocities, they are not mad, they may be bad. Put another way, that genocides and mass atrocities are committed by ordinary people, just like you and me, but who have been traumatically influenced. But what is the mechanism by which these risk factors and the vulnerabilities interact to generate the actual pathology of genocide? After all, very few risky environments become genocidal settings, and not all susceptible hosts become mass atrocity killers. We must answer this practical question because we know from long observation that ordinary people don't actually like committing the armed brutalities that are necessary to get the job done. I don't know if you have read the diaries of the Nazi concentration camps, commanders, but if not, you should do so. These are the logs, the daily diaries kept by the not even Nazis, German soldiers, members of German military, even not Nazis, who were in charge of the concentration camps. So when they started the business of putting the Jews in the concentration camps, they used to record each evening their experiences. And you can see in the diary how those who were committing these murders, they were very upset themselves. They would write in the diary, oh, today I had a terrible day. I put 10,000 people in the gas chamber. It was terrible. I don't like this job, but what to do? I'm under order, etc. Then you keep on reading these diaries. 2 years later, the same person is not mentioning anything about how he feels. It is as if he's doing his normal job. We know that ordinary people don't like doing bad things because ordinary people are generally good people, and yet they become bad people. So why? And that we have to understand if we have to have any chance to have the responsibility to protect or to prevent. In summary, the pathogenesis of mass atrocities is mediated through three routes. First comes dehumanization. So the transported Jews became just goods during the Holocaust. The Tutsis of Rwanda were insects to be crushed, and the citizens of Blue Nile State are black plastic bags to be swept away. This is the instructions from President Bashir to his army in the Blue Nile State. What the orders are, clean the countryside of these black plastic bags. Make sure there is no litter. So the people of Blue Nile, these of African tribes, they are now called black plastic bags, dehumanized. Second is the creation of distancing. Research has shown that the further away you are from your victims, the more efficient you are at brutalizing or killing them. Hence, perhaps, the increasing popularity nowadays of drones. In genocidal history, we saw this distancing through the creation of a specific genocide-minded bureaucratic system in which many ordinary individuals played small, often banal roles, each of this person could say, not me, I didn't do it, I was just doing my ordinary job. And this you learn very graphically if you take the time while you are in Paris to travel a couple of miles away to visit the Holocaust Center here, right here in Paris, which is one of the best Holocaust education centers in the world. As you enter there, you will see the history of the Holocaust as it affected France and Paris, all laid out. There are exhibits, there are artifacts and so on. Has anyone been there? No? Okay. So one person in this group, this is a shame, this is a disgrace, especially those of you who are Parisians, because you must know your history. Because the risk factor that we saw on my slide is the greatest chance of a future atrocity is a past history of atrocities. So forgive me, Parisians who are here, you're not educated if you've not been to see the Holocaust Center in Paris. Take some time and do it. What do you see there? You see in this shelves, the ordinary business of how 72,000 French Jews were disappeared. So you see in one cage the log of the local préfet of some arrondissement, some local thing. And you see the record of the French Office of Population Censuses, identification of people according to their identity. Next door, you see the log of the French Railways clerk who is booking the Jews onto the cattle trucks to be sent to Belsen and Auschwitz and so on. So you see, as if they are just reserving seats. Today, when I come from Geneva, I come by train sometimes, and you go online and you book your seat. They didn't have that system in the SNCF in those days. I don't know what it was called, the French Railways. But you see, the ordinary business of booking these Jews into the cattle trucks as if they were just simply ordinary day-to-day job. So the policeman, the civil servant, the railway station attendant, organizing the transport as if it was just scheduling a train from Paris to Lyon or somewhere. These are the little jobs that were being done by ordinary people in Paris, French people in Paris, each of them not knowing what the whole project was about. And each of them could then say, well, I'm only doing my job. And the accumulation of those little jobs led to the most efficient disappearance of 72,000 French citizens. Anyway, the good thing about France, and I compliment the French here, is that they are very open to this. Because the disappearance of these French Jews wasn't just the German Nazis who did it. The German Nazis just issued an ideology. The work was done by the French bureaucracy. And it preceded 80 years or 100 years of anti-Jew culture that had grown all over Europe. You can understand then that the Holocaust in this continent, which has given us two world wars, was almost inevitable. It was bound to happen after 100 years of a hate culture that had grown up all over Europe. Third is a progressive desensitization. When you kill one person, it's kind of quite difficult, it's personal. But killing gets easier, and killing lots is then just about meeting targets. As has been said, to kill one person is a tragedy. To kill millions is just a statistic. Once the process has started, the logic of mass killing is so compelling and self-perpetuating that it is almost impossible to stop the genocidal machine. Because the machine just goes on, and the killings get automatic and automatic. And there's a logic. You know, if someone was to come in and wanting to kill us all, the logic would be to kill everyone. You just don't just kill one or two people. So the question is how to interrupt this logic. Because once it starts, you have to complete the job. So now, dear friends, we have some insight into the etiology of the mass atrocity mindset. And the public health of primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention may allow us to examine if we can do something about it. To start with, primary prevention. If the hypothesis is correct that all ordinary people have the propensity to commit evil, and that vulnerability to this is evolutionary, then absolute primary prevention is probably impossible, as a special evil can arise at any time in any place. It's a bit like smoking. We know that smoking is a risk factor for lung cancer. Therefore, it's better to stop smoking. And there are more lung cancers in smokers than non-smokers. But we know that lung cancer also happens in non-smokers. Therefore, if the propensity to commit evil is intrinsic in the human condition, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Whether or not you deal with the risk factors. Of course, it's better to deal with the risk factors, as I'll go on to say. But there's no vaccine or genetic engineering possibility against mass atrocities. And although poverty reduction and development, including particularly education, are worthy investments to make for other good reasons, there is scant evidence that economically better off and educated societies are automatically more resistant to the siren calls of hatred. In fact, some of the most evil masterminds of mass atrocities have also been amongst our most smart fellows, for it needs a sharp, well-read mind to construct the complex ideology and manufacture the persuasive advocacy needed to design and run the mass atrocity machine. By and large, mass atrocities are committed by educated, smart people. Stupid people, uneducated people, don't go around doing mass designing mass murder. They just can't. They're just too stupid to do it. They're disorganized to do it. This is done by the most educated people in the world. And some of the most, the genocides we know in Europe, for example, took place in developed societies. However, even if prevention is probably not fully possible, can we do something about genocide risk reduction, analogous to the notion of disaster or health risk reduction? So if we go back to the risk factors table, probably the key measure worth adopting and that is closest to tackling the root cause of genocide is broad-based democratic governance. This is, of course, a long-term, multi-sector, and complex business. And even then, democracy is no guarantee of immunity. For example, even Nazism arose out of the manipulation and subversion of the German democratic or German democracy of that time. And Rwanda was, at least in form, a democratic country, despite having a dictatorial president at the time that the genocide happened. Democracy by itself is not a protection against mass atrocities. Turning to secondary prevention, which is concerned with the diagnosis and early treatment of a morbid condition at its earliest stages, this may be translated into conventional humanitarian language of early warning, early action. By and large, the track record here is largely that of failure. Not a single genocide in history has ever been prevented, even though at least in modern times we have generally had plenty of early warning. My own personal experiences as a representative of the UK government during the last genocide of the 20th century in Rwanda and Srebrenica, and then as the head of the United Nations in the Sudan, witnessing the first genocide of the 21st century in Darfur, brought home to me the reasons for failure. And I won't go through that, but when I was the head of the UN in the Sudan dealing with Darfur and tried to do something to draw attention to it, these are some of the factors why the world would not listen to what was going on. And remember, after Rwanda, we said, never again. And yet it happened again, and again, and it'll happen again. We can discuss this if you have time. I'm going to finish soon. The doctrine of responsibility to protect, adopted by the UN with such fanfare in 2005, has generally proved a disappointment. So R2P may be more accurately called the responsibility to prevaricate, not the responsibility to protect, for the reasons here. Put simply, these excuses for failure are diagnostic of international institutional failure on a system-wide basis. And at the root core of this is a failure or cowardice of leadership. We said earlier that genocide is an act of ordinary men. To that, we may add, in the words of Edmund Burke, all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. Last week, I was also in Paris at the invitation of a French group called Collectif Agence Darfur. And I was also invited by the French Foreign Ministry, the Quai d'Orsay, where I had a discussion with the special representative of the president on human rights and these kinds of issues, and we had a good discussion with the French diplomats and so on. And I said to my French Ministry of Foreign Affairs colleagues that last week I was returning to the Quai d'Orsay for the first time in 10 years. 10 years ago, when I was the head of the United Nations in Sudan, I came to Paris and I told the French government about what was going on in Darfur. They received me very well. They gave me a very nice lunch. The French Foreign Service is very good at giving you nice hospitality, but they did not listen. So I returned to Paris 10 years later and say, what happens when you don't listen? And I'm only saying, targeting the French because I happen to be in Paris. The same thing happened in relation to my own government in Britain as well as other governments. But the point is that it is not for lack of information or early warning that we fail. It is for the lack of the will. So how to understand that? And here are some of the reasons why we fail. So what would be the prescription for such failure in the spirit of the secondary prevention track? At the core of this is the issue of the accountability of decision makers. The geopolitical and organizational aspects of this could be discussed, but of greater relevance to this forum is a question to you. Most seemingly good people stand by and do nothing when they see cruelty being visited upon their fellow citizens. Why? My own experience suggests that the answer lies in the final item number 12 on that list, and that is empathy deficit. The words of the United Nations, beautiful words of the United Nations Charter, the first words of the United Nations Charter says, we the peoples. Where are the peoples? The head of the United Nations or the head of any big organization sits right up there. In the case of the UN, it's on the 38th floor. We the peoples are on the road. And in the case of the most vulnerable, they're not even on the road. They're hidden under the road. The gap between the 38th floor and under the road is as far apart as the distance to Mars. So for most of our institutions, these issues become geopolitical, academic events to be managed with national interest. It is not surprising that policymakers, and the higher you are, the more distant you are, and the greater your responsibility to act and why you fail. Finally, on tertiary prevention. This is concerned with reducing the consequences of genocide, and there is probably a lot more that can be done here. This is important because we know already that the most important risk for future genocide and mass atrocity is a history of past genocide. As the philosopher George Santayana wrote, those who cannot learn from history are doomed to repeat it. That's why I said with huge respect to my friends, the Parisians, go and see the Holocaust Center right here in this very city. This is the reason why in post-genocidal societies and post-mass atrocity situations, there is so much emphasis placed on commemorations and memorials as permanent visible reminders of traumatic events. Rwanda, which is going to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the 94 genocide next year, and Darfur will commemorate its 10th. Rwanda is a land of memorials. There is one in every street corner. To accompany that, there has to be an honest and accurate narrative that is told in schools and wherever collective memory is shaped. To bring about accountability and justice is a necessary part of this. And though there is a debate on the trade-off between justice and peace, those who say, let's have peace first and then we'll have justice. But the lesson of history is that without justice, there is no peace. There is not a single peace agreement in the world that has ever struck. If you go back to the big experiences of Latin America, Central America in the 1990s, through to all the African conflicts that we have seen, north and south, in the last 10, 15 years, right down to the present day, in the Congo, in Sudan, and probably even in Syria. No peace agreement works without a justice and accountability track in it right at the very beginning. So those, like in the Quai d'Orsay here, or the British Foreign Minister, they say, oh, don't worry, we will have peace agreement first, and then we will bring the perpetrators to trial of all those who've done this mass murder. They are wrong. It hasn't worked in the past. There's no reason why it should work in the future. The memories and experiences of the mass atrocity survivors themselves are the primary resources for the healing journey. We see this, for example, in Rwanda, still traumatized 2 decades on from the education programs that they've got out there, which is a central part of the process of national reconciliation and recovery. My dear friends, before I finish, cruelty starts in the minds and hearts of men, and I emphasize men. And that is where it must be stopped. In the case of the world's most evil traumas, this is even more important because we know from empirical evidence that this is transmitted across generations. In fact, to reiterate from my earlier slide, a history of previous atrocity is the best predictor of future atrocity. Thus, what we call tertiary prevention is also possibly the most important contribution to primary prevention. In conclusion, where are we now? The 20th century can truly be called the century of mass atrocities. It has been the bloodiest and most brutal in all human history. And the 21st century has not started well either. But on the other side, we have also made much more progress in understanding more deeply and honestly the truth about our shared human condition, and that is a good base from where to look to the future. We've also developed new advantages, globalization and communication. No longer can evil things happen in the darkness, and we are interconnected. Interconnectedness generates innovation, develops further and better social norms, such as less tolerance of the abuses that have historically plagued us, and generates a shared will to act and ensure justice and accountability. From here, this evening, I'm actually going to go on straight to Istanbul to see for myself what is going on there. This is helped by a better understanding of how our minds work and what shapes our behaviors, good and bad. Yes, I have said that evil is a product of perfectly ordinary men and that all of us are capable of this. But we also know from many examples that ordinary people can demonstrate incredible courage in the face of the most dire challenges, and ultimately the human spirit is quite resilient. It seems that the evil propensity in us is matched also by the propensity to do good. But in ending, I'm left with a very disturbing thought. And this worries me. I'm wondering if there would have been a genocide convention without Hitler. Would there have been a Mahatma Gandhi without the indignity of colonization? Would there have been a Martin Luther King without civil rights abuses? Would there have been a Nelson Mandela if there had not been apartheid? In other words, the theologian and philosopher Eliza Berkowitz said it, without evil, goodness would not be possible either. Without the forever lurking inclination to selfishness and discord, there can be no ethical ideal and practice. So, is it necessary for evil to first flourish, for good to eventually happen? It's a question we can all ask ourselves. Thank you.